Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Castobras Podcast with a K. My name is Christian Corley, and with me this week is James McLean.
Hello.
And delighted to say that our good friend Gareth Cavanagh is also here to discuss Doctor Who Series 11, Episode 6, Demons of the Punjab. Hello, Gareth.
Hello.
How are you? You well?
I'm aching like buggery, and I've got a cold, but nobody cares about that. So, yes, I'm fine.
Half the course this time of year, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Listen, we're halfway through Doctor Who Series 11. You haven't been on the podcast for quite a few weeks. How are you finding it so far?
Well, let's see. I have to confess, I've only watched half of them. I was pretty positive about it moving to Sundays. And I think Sundays, perfect night for it, blah, blah, blah. Until I then suddenly remembered I work every Sunday scrubbing out arcade machines. Don't get home until about 9. Not really in the mood to sit down and watch Doctor Who at that point. And unfortunately, what's happening is I'm then going on Facebook and everyone's going, that were great, that were crap, that were great, that were crap. And on it goes. So, and then Monday, all my big shows hit that I like, Walking Dead and all these, there's loads to watch. And then by the time it gets to Tuesday, I'm finding the fizz has gone out of my enthusiasm to watch it. So as a consequence, I've only watched the first one, which I enjoyed. I watched the Rosa Parks one, which I enjoyed. And I watched last night, this morning, instead of watching the finale to The Last Ship, because I knew we were having this chat. So I thought I'd better watch it. So that's my caveat with it. So it's changing my relationship with Doctor Who, this move to a Sunday. That said, I broadly enjoyed it last night. But if I'm going to expand, it's definitely a different show now. I think it's moving towards a more emotional heart. And I think the way it's going in years to come, people aren't going to be going, oh my God, Doctor Who was so scary, I hid behind the sofa, like, you know, the traditional lore. I think it's moving to, oh my God, Doctor Who was so emotional, it broke my heart last night, or ooh, that speech, or do you know what I mean? I think it's become a very different show, and I think that's probably a good thing, but it's a very different Doctor Who.
Okay, interesting. We've been offering ratings of the episodes as we go through the discuss them so far this series.
Out of 10,
yeah.
Like Alan Hansen and Jimmy Hill used to do for England games.
Yeah, with less chin rags. But So we'll probably come to that at the end. So I'm just giving you forewarning there, Gareth. That is likely to be asked for this episode, at least. So, Demons of the Punjab, in which the Doctor did a kind of Father's Day thing without the Father's Day thing and took Naz back to 1947 by accident, because it should be 1950. Typical TARDIS, not being able to be steered correctly. To the Punjab during the partition in 1947, where Pakistan was broken off from India.
Hold on. There's something cleverer than that there, to be fair. It's that idea that the Doctor takes you where you need to be, not where you want to go. So because it's reading where it has to go off the watch, it's gone back to the broke watch.
Okay, fair enough. It is down to the Doctor. Some monsters appear, but it's really about the people, not the monsters. I think it's probably time we heard from James.
You sure?
Yes. Demons of the Punjab, James. Where are you with it?
I really liked it.
Yeah.
It's probably the most interesting and clever Doctor Who I've seen for a long time. Mm-hmm. Rosa was good, but as we said, there were things in Rosa which perhaps didn't totally work, but I really liked Rosa. But this, to me, was where the show should be going. Maybe, could be argued, maybe a little long. Maybe there's a couple of areas which could have done, which, especially for kids, I don't feel this show is really aimed at under 12s.
Definitely not.
But over 12s, I think there was a lot here, providing you weren't gnashing at the teeth for Stephen Moffat or Russell T Davis. and you go with it. I think there was a lot to be said there. I thought some great subversions. I mean, at the beginning, when the demons, as they called them, popped up, I was like, oh God, here we go. Here we go, demons interfering into the historical event. And then there's that lovely switch about halfway through where it turns out not only are they not the enemy, which is the sort of thing where you go, oh yeah, okay, we've seen this before as well, where actually they're okay. We kind of saw that last week. But they actually get pulled right out of the story. And I thought that was really clever. So they set them up there to sort of carry the expectation through. But as soon as they reveal what they are, they disappear till the last 5 minutes or so because they're no longer relevant. And I thought that was a brilliant take. And then that takes you back to the real threat, which is this political historical threat, which, you know, we haven't seen Doctor Who do something like that, which suddenly the story becomes utterly historical since, you know, well, probably since sort of like Black Orchid. It's that sort of thing. And that was really interesting. And then you have this wonderful setup with the companions where for once, the first time I've ever seen in the new series, certainly, companions actually do as they're told. And, they do not actually, they actually hold their anger and their upset. They don't, even more so than in Rosa. And they actually sit back and they let history take the pace it has to do. And you can see how very painful that is for them. But suddenly you have these mature companion characters, which aren't there to sort of do this sort of selfish bravery, which in the end is what even Yaz would be doing if she interfered, because she wants to try and sort things out. But even she as a character sort of understands that she can't, and she's just got to step back. And I thought that was brilliant. I mean, it goes against this sort of narrative, which is still being played in this series as it's been played in the other series, that they're going for these great adventures, and that's why they're hanging around, which I still feel is a dead and belittling ideology for the series, where until Arachnids for Gareth, you have this idea that they're just stuck with her, following her through time, and then they get to Arachnids episode 4, and suddenly we're back to doing what we've done in the last 13 years, and we go back home to contemporary Sheffield, and they have to decide whether they want to come along. And after seeing people cocooned by spiders and the death in the previous episodes, they realise, of course, you know, going around the universe is a rip-roaring, fun, exciting ride. You know, let's watch people suffer. And they go down that ideology. But in this one, even though that's still there, the way they handle it is far more mature and respectful. And yeah, I know I'm over-talking now, but that was a really good story. I was really impressed with it. And even though it had the family bit at the beginning, which, again, as I've just said, I hate them going back to the families. I've always hated that. I find it a very tepid way to try and show a personality of a character by showing their relationship to their family, which is okay, it's fine, but you don't have to do that. You shouldn't have to do that every episode 4. But the use of the family in this actually had a really important setup and delivery.
It's integral, isn't it? That's right. Yes. That's integral. I mean, I suppose you could have done it another way. It could have been that Nanny has died and she gets left the watch in the will and says, this is really important. Sorry, I couldn't tell you about it. Then goes back. It's clever, and I like it, and I like the emotional heart of it is good. I didn't really need the aliens, though.
No, I don't think you do, but I think
that
the aliens are
of anxiety and cringe that, you know, oh my God, will people turn off if it's just, you
it
know,
could be. Or was it
of the intolerant fundamentalists coming over the hill, and we know that this man will die?
I mean, what is it that, I mean, is it an underconfidence in its audience? Was it, I mean, as I say, that's what I tend to normally think. And watching this, I just wasn't totally sure whether it was just to play that switch and play to an audience expectation and then turn it totally around and deliver something.
To a degree, but they're only there really to do the same job as Death in the Seventh Seal, aren't they? But when they turn up, you know that he's had it.
There's a touch of the Hitchhikers / Pratchett to the monsters, aliens, they twist it.
I thought Hitchhikers in that, who's that guy who turns up, who's immortal and travels the universe insulting everyone?
Yes.
And it is almost like that. And I thought, oh my God, they're the blokes from Hitchhikers who turns up, Dent, you're a complete arsehole. So I wonder if they're going to come back and save the day later on.
I hope not. I mean, I still, I mean, for me, I still feel that they are there to sort of try and, I don't know whether it worked or not, given we have different opinions on this, so maybe it didn't. I kind of felt the idea was to sort of try and emphasize, it was to try and bring in the standard foreigner, sort of bring in the standard other. And, you know, you're meant to assume that they're the ones behind all this, and then to strip that away and go, no, the actual enemy here is something which people actually in this country still consider the other themselves. Some people do have concerns about Indian, Pakistan, Muslim, and then actually sort of reveal the complexities under there which don't need the monsters. Or maybe you're right. Maybe it was something which was in the script, and late in the script, someone came along, maybe Chibnall or whoever, and said, or writer's room, if they allegedly did do that in the end, and they decided, well, actually, why don't we pull these things away and just let the rest speak? And maybe it was a decision in the writing process, and so you've got like almost like a two-split.
I think it's a confidence, and I think I get a sense that Chibnall's pulling away from now 13 years of established, this is what Doctor Who is. And if you go back in time, there has to be, as you say, the other.
Mm.
And I think now I think the ratings are probably at a point where he's now going to be able to say, you know what, I don't need to have a broken bit of technology or a this or a that to justify being in the past. We can just be in the past. And I think now there's that lovely restraint, as you said, companions do what they're told. There's no grandstanding. There's no big speech from the doctor or the, you know, or the companion. I mean, God, I mean, Rosa could have been awful at certain points in Doctor Who.
Yes.
Could have been absolutely, you know, chew your fingers off, awful. And it isn't, because there's the restraint and the respect. And, you know, someone described to me the worst part of Capaldi, and he really summed it up. They said, the problem with Capaldi's Doctor is he becomes Bono on holiday bragging about charity work. Oh my God, right. So right. And Bono on holiday in Alabama bragging about his charity work would have been hideous. I mean, hideous. And the worst thing is, people who make that wouldn't have seen it would have been hideous. They'd have gone, it's wonderful. This subtlety, it's nice. And there's a restraint, and there's a respect, and there's a... And I quite like what Joe Whittaker's doing with it as well. There's, you know, she's playing the restraint and standing back, and that's nice. That I haven't seen for an awfully long time. You know, I mean, you know, if this had been a Moffat episode, the Demons of the Punjab, you know, he'd have done something clever and saved the lad. He would have done. There's no way he'd have just had him shot in the field coldly.
And have them walking away.
Yeah, there'd have been some where he resurrects him. He'd have dropped him off on, you know, the planet Punjab in a million years in the future, where he'd have gone on and, you know...
The Punjab spaceship in Beast World.
There'd have been a Punjab spaceship that would have saved him. A Punjab time-travelling spaceship that would have said, actually, we need this guy because he's really important to us, like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures. So the restraint, the respect, is nice. Actually, I realised I didn't know very much about that particular aspect of history.
Yeah,
just
same kind
here. Of think that Lord Mountbatten just goes, right, chaps, there you go, you can have it all back. We're off now. Good luck. Enjoy the rule of law and all the legal systems we've left you. See you in a few years when it's all settled down.
Well, there's a few things about this. Just to, because, you know, we talk about India as being India, but it was never India before we got there, before the British and the other European companies got there. It was just lots of groups, not even states, just like areas. So it is a very complicated area. And I think there's a Who Do You Think You Are, or two or three Who Do You Think You Are, so people have looked into this period of time. And it is quite a fractious thing. So to be able to... I think successfully relate that, certainly give an educating gist of it in 45 minutes or so is a good thing. I do feel, however, that this episode is going to be overshadowed by Rosa in much the same way, although completely different stories, that Human Nature is overshadowed by Blink. I think Human Nature is far subtler than Blink. I think this is far subtler and far better than Rosa. Rosa feels like a greatest hits history lesson. This is much, much better.
What do you think? What I liked about Rosa, though, was the Back to the Future 2-ness of it.
I find it more bad episode of Quantum Leap than Back to the Future 2, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Yeah, it feels like it's trying to do too much. It feels like it's trying too hard, basically. But by complete contrast, Demons of the Punjab is far better. You mentioned ratings earlier, and this is something that I wanted to talk about in this week's podcast. There was a tweet went out by J.R. Southall about average audience per Doctor, and showing how this era of Doctor Who's doing very well in terms of audience ratings. However, while it is doing very well with audience ratings, there is a problem with Doctor Who's audience appreciation.
Right.
Now, Series 1, actually I've tweeted this, so I'll go to the tweet actually, because it's a lot easier to summarise. But basically, Doctor Who's audience appreciation average has been a bit naff since Series 8. And it's still a bit naff at the moment. So far, obviously, we've only got half a series, so we can't go on it. You know, we can't say, oh, it's not recovered. But after last week's episode, which had the Saranga conundrum, which had one of the lowest audience appreciation scores since Doctor Who returned, 79. The lowest before that, I think I'm right in saying, was Love and Monsters. No, it wasn't. No, actually, it was the... It was the Sleep No More, which had 78.
No, really? I love Sleep No More.
It's certainly a mixed reaction is Sleep No More. I'm just going to bring up my actual.
I hated Sleep No More.
Here we go. So Eccleston's average viewing figure was 8.82, and the average AI was 8.277. Tennant's average viewing figure was 9 million, average AI 86.63. Smith's average audience was 8.83 million, average AI 86.13. Capaldi's average audience was 7.69, thanks to some specials mainly. Average AI 82.79. Whittaker so far 9.14. This is before any figures for Demons of the Punjab. Average AI 81.75, which has been dragged down by the Saranga conundrum,
which I haven't seen, but you know, taking the temperature on Facebook, it does seem to be acknowledged as a bit of a stinker.
It was all right, I think.
It was below average. It was 79 AI. Everything, and the general pattern across this is that the Tennant's and Smith eras appear to be largely over 85 on a couple of occasions, surpassing 90. Whereas Capaldi was below 85.
If JR is, but you know, we have to qualify this, and I know JR, I've met JR, but JR is the high priest of Stephen Moffat.
Just to correct, this isn't from JR, is it?
All right. No, it's just me.
I've
compiled the AI scores.
I mean, but JR's done the same, and the numbers are pretty much the same, to be fair. Yeah. But he's actually very pro at the moment.
JR did the audience and the average chart position for Doctor Who.
He's fighting for Whittaker, but equally he is still very much pro Moffat as well.
Yeah,
but
whereas I would say the problem started with Peter Capaldi, and so far, in terms of AI, it hasn't really recovered.
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's dig into that. Smith era is a lot longer than people remember. And I wonder how the AI compares from Smith beginning to Smith end.
It largely holds up. It starts at 86, finishes with 83, with some 88s and 87s before it. So, yeah.
Okay, I mean, the only thing I would say is you've still got... The two factors I would throw in here, and this is not me trying to be pro Whittaker, but just as a devil's advocate. It's slightly pro Whittaker, because I've said before, I don't think there's a massive difference in this series. Not a massive, massive difference. And I don't think there's a massive difference in Capaldi's stories to Smith. I think first of all, you've got a show which is now 13 years old. Yeah. So appreciations will start to drop, I would think, inevitably. They're going to peak and then they're going to start dropping. Secondly, I think, again, I don't know how they're actually correlated, but it'd be interesting to see what audience appreciations other shows are getting, to see whether there is, just in case there is a downward trend, or even an upward trend, making this even worse. Who knows? But without those comparatives, I find it hard to say. But to me, this feels like, because Capaldi and Whittaker are about the same. Southall says he calculates 82.7, 82.75 for Capaldi and Whittaker. But then I don't know if he's counting last week's, as you are, Christian. So maybe that's before the 79, which, as you say, bring a drop.
People deploy these statistics to suit their own audience.
Absolutely,
overnights. You know, when overnights dropped, when overnights were high, we were told overnights are fantastic. That's what it's about. When overnights dropped, people then started saying, well, it's not all about
the overnights. It's just the overnights. No, ignore those. Wait until the real figures come in.
Wait till the real things, and then magically it all kind of fills up. I think overnights probably, in some sense, they are less important. But in other sense, now I'm not watching it live. I'm literally... it's sort of drifting out of my attention sphere if I have a busy Monday and Tuesday as well.
Mm.
So maybe the overnights are important.
You know what I think from this is that, big fan of Peter Capaldi. I want to like Jodie's doctor more than I do, and I find myself preferring Jodie Whittaker to Jodie Whittaker's doctor. But overall, yeah. I think... And, you know, as much as I like Peter Capaldi, I do think that maybe, is there a correlation between these AI scores and the person playing the Doctor?
Yeah, I think it's got to be there.
And I do wonder whether there is a failure in casting. Now, I don't want to be critical of any actor, because it's not down to the actor, it's down to who's casting them and where they go from there. And I think Demons of the Punjab is going to have a higher AI. I imagine it's going to be probably 84 or 85. It's at least, it's got to get a better score than Rosa, I would have thought, which was 83. So that's going to up this average for this series so far. And I imagine this series will finish around 82, 83, like the previous ones have. But I do wonder if this has got something to do with casting, and whether or not the BBC are having trouble finding. And this is going to go back to some previous conversation we've had, but finding a smart, a modern Tennant replacement or a Smith replacement.
You see, I don't think that... I'm not convinced.
I'm not saying that's going to... I'm not saying the show has to be the same as that. I'm saying, are they... they're not finding someone who's as compelling to watch as those guys.
I'm just very aware that we are now into 10, 13 years. Capaldi was after 10 years. I'm just for people watching the show, this is now how many hundred and whatever episodes of the show we've now run into.
Yeah,
that's a lot. The sparkle from it, the excitement, will inevitably die in the way that thankfully a surgeon gets used to looking at meat and doesn't get shocked and horrified by it. You know, eventually we adapt, and unfortunately for television, that's always a problem, because it means it becomes a lot harder to get people feelings appreciative about stuff, because they're used to it. It's what they get. They've seen many forms and variations before. I turn on and watch Doctor Who. It doesn't really give me the same sort of thrill as it did when I turned on in 2006. I can critically appreciate episodes, think that was really good or that was really terrible, but I don't get the same sort of thrust. And the only reason I put this up, because I've had this argument with my old video games producer, who contacts me weekly to talk about this. We come from two different backgrounds on this argument. It's my same argument for Star Wars as well. Is I still kind of feel that we exist within a bubble which largely is of sort of white 40-year-old men who are on Twitter as well.
It's a big demographic, though.
Posting. It's a demographic which is important to Doctor Who. But what I'm saying is I kind of wonder whether the show is now working better for a younger audience. Now, the obvious argument against that is, well, that's got nothing to do with the AI. But the show ratings seem to be pretty strong at the moment. There's not that massive downturn that people are expecting. It's holding out, and its percentage share of the audience per week is remaining fairly level. So people are coming back to it to watch it, who are watching TV that night.
It's being talked about. And I think, Do you know what? Do you know what's at the heart of this, is behind all of this, is cancellation anxiety. This is why certain fans and groups of fans obsess about ratings. And now we're obsessing about AI, because although the ratings are high, the AI is slipping. So we think, oh my God, you know, that's like our goal difference is slipping. So it's like, we still think that at some point it's going to be taken off the air, because even if it's not for the ratings, it'll be the AI. I think we just have to learn to sit back and remember two things. One is that when it is cancelled, it'll be cancelled for entirely the BBC's own reasons. It'll come down to either money, or it'll come down to someone approaches them with a big, big deal, and which means it has to be taken off air for a long time, completely retooled and relaunched. I think that's literally our cancellation scenarios. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to learn to just enjoy it and relax. And as you just quite rightly said, James, it is being made now for a new audience. And I think it's being made for a bigger audience. I think Doctor Who in recent years had become very niche, very narrow, didn't quite know what it was. It wasn't family viewing. It wasn't sort of mature viewing. It kind of didn't know who who its audience was. And I think we discussed it previously when the Bible, the brand guide said, this is a show for sort of 18 to 25 year olds, I seem to remember. And I thought, God, that's really narrow. And I'm not even sure that it's working for that demographic. So Doctor Who now, I think, knows what it is. It's family viewing. It's Sunday evening adult viewing. It's teen and young adult viewer. And there's still enough to sort of titillate us old dinosaurs sliding towards fandom's tar pit, where we will sink and be forgotten.
But I think there is a truth there. I don't think it's just fans trying to find a reason why it's failing. I think, to be fair, I think for fans who've been watching it, say, I take the white 40-year-old because it's sort of a majority Doctor Who fan demographic, I suspect, with some
confidence. It's a strata we live in.
Who've watched it for a long time, this is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just wonder for them, for us, you know, Jodie Whittaker, the change there, even though the majority have accepted the change and are going with it and are able to critically assess it fairly, it's still a change. And I think there's a lot of still trying to get one's head around that. Because I see people saying that, you know, oh my God, it's so lectury, it's so preachy now. All she does is preach. And I've said this before. I don't find her actually, if you take her dialogue and slap it onto Moffat or Tennant or any other doctor, it's not that preachy and it's not that expositionary. Oh, it's a gendered thing.
Less preachy. It's less preachy. The worst thing I can remember in recent years, and I must be out of step because everyone seems to love it, is that big long speech the doctor gives at the end of the Zygon thing about war.
Yeah.
And it's awful and it seems to go on forever. And worse than that, it makes the Doctor a total complete hypocrite for his entire life, because the Doctor's relationship with violence is always a tricky one at best. You know, that's literally, you know, the man who sparked 1,000 pub fights standing up in the middle of a pub saying, no one must fight. It's awful, you know.
I think a lot of this, you know,
bottle someone else with.
Yeah, this whole thing about being preachy or the whole social justice thing, I do wonder if maybe if people are finding this being a thing rather than ignoring it as a thing or just accepting it as part of a story. As part of the writing, I do wonder if maybe just there's too much kind of, what's the best way of putting this, a sort of reliance on topical stuff to provide extra texture to the story rather than actually writing the story.
But Doctor Who's always been about relevance.
It has always, as I've said, you know, I think it's something to do with the writing now. I think
era where you just have endless rehashes of bases under siege where the commander's losing his shit because it's all a bit stressful and they're being subverted from within and then the Doctor blows it up at the end. You know, and oddly enough, we all seem to think that run of 3 years in the 60s is amazing, and it's not. and I think, you know, it's Barry Letts who who bravely brings in, you know, that sort of the social issues. You know, it's done covertly and
subtly. With subtlety, and that's the point I'm making.
Well, I don't think there's much subtle about the Green Death. That is
no, but it's. I agree. But it, and yet it works so much better than Spiders in Sheffield.
Well, I haven't seen that one, so I can't.
Well, I mean, but then does it work better because Spiders in Sheffield is almost like a callback to some of those things which were being done in the Green Death like 40 years ago, where television was a different beast. And I would argue that it, like in the 70s, where you did see a certain maturity moving in British television as well to sort of more social topics, which allowed Doctor Who an opening to start looking at social topics. Here, Doctor Who is responding to the state of the land again, which is a lot more about covering the questions of minorities, ethnicities, of various prejudice. And you see that through various dramas on Netflix and on, well, mainly on Netflix, to be fair.
I think the words I'm looking for is perhaps, in this regard purely, is self-parody. When the Rolling Stones go out and Mick Jagger, who spends most of his days watching cricket, then starts prancing about on stage like he did when he was 25. And you know he's not totally into it. You know he's not really doing it. He's doing it because that's what's expected. He's doing it because everyone else is doing it.
He's doing it because he's a sack of loot that appears.
Yeah, he's doing it because he started it and feels that he still has to do it and do it better, more forthright than everyone else is doing it. I think that's what's going on, perhaps, an element of that at least. Listen, we're going to hit Facebook, all right? Because there's a lot of comments on Facebook about this episode, as it should be. Luke James, I want to love this, but I don't. Boring, dull, bad acting, bad dialogue, overacting. Thank God for Bradley Walsh. Ruth Wheeler joins in. Bradley really is the only thing saving it. I think this week it was quite low on the Bradley Walsh quotient. He wasn't a key element to it. He was good as always, and he does kind of have this quality where he does tend to dominate every scene that he's in. Whether he's actually... if he doesn't dominate it, he's not dominating it because he's actually consciously keeping his own space. And watch Bradley Walsh as well when his reactions, even when he's not engaged in the conversation, he's marvellous, yeah.
Do you think he's sometimes... I mean, I've only seen three, so I can only comment three I've seen. But I think he's almost becoming a surrogate doctor in some of the scenes.
In some of them, some ways.
I think this is, as you said before, this is very much a callback to the early 60s, this whole series. He's playing Ian Chesterton. The whole series has got a feel of those, even especially the ending of this episode, where you have that non-intervention, them walking away from a point in history, is very Hartnell-esque. More brutal than Hartnell, but it's that sort of flow that Hartnell goes for. So I think he is doing, he's doing an Ian Chesterton. That's what he's being used as.
Yeah. Nick Caulfield was worried we'd have another Father's Day, but somehow it wasn't. At the end, my eyes were damp, even though I knew how the narrative was playing me. It still did that. I was a little concerned that British TV take on a historical event like that may have been a little... the outsider view in, but I saw a comment on a post elsewhere saying that person's great grand and his sister died on the journey from Pakistan to India. A little bit of story there. So he's contextualizing it for Nick there. So he considers it better than the spiders or the medical ship episodes. Gary Akers says, this is the best episode in years. Capitals, hence the shouty. Beautifully written, acted and shot. Gorgeous, mesmerizing and heartbreaking. Whittaker, Gill and Walsh absolutely knocked it out of the park. Without Chibnall, I expected it to be better than what we've been getting, but not this good. All the episodes so far have been written or co-written by Chris Chibnall up until Demons of the Punjab.
You would expect that because it's a complete relaunch. I'm pretty sure Russell must have written or co-written
first two, I think. He wrote Rose, and he wrote End of the World, and then episode three is The Unquiet Dead, which is Mark Gatiss. Then it goes back to Russell until Dalek.
Yeah, so he more or less did write those first five.
Okay.
And there is a question of how much Chibnall's writing when he's having an associate credit as well. In the same way that, you know, there's a question over how much, when you have those associate credits, who's taking the biggest chunk. I don't know. But yes, anyway, so carry on.
Andrew WM Fairbrass, maybe he's changed his name on Facebook just to save me struggling as to whether it's his real name or not. Not perfect by a long way, but the best epi-sermon of this later series by a long distance.
Epi-sermon?
Now, I had to Google epi-sermon.
That's idiot.
It seems to be a concatenation of episode and sermon.
Sermon, yes.
Yeah.
This preachiness is being levelled at it. Because seriously, I haven't found this preachy at all.
No.
It's almost a sort of... It's almost... I mean, you're from an academic background, aren't you, Jim? And I find that this, to me, is almost like a sort of a nearly a dispassionate academic's view of history. In that it's a sort of like, yeah, history is horrible and this is dreadful and we can't do anything more. We must observe, you know, in the same way that academics can really consider some quite horrible subjects and come to conclusions. It's kind of approach.
Yeah.
It's not emotional in involvement. It's almost standing back and appraising.
I agree. I don't think this is. I think this sermon lecture notion, which is being used banded around, is sort of speaking to three things. I think one of them sometimes can be a question of story. I think one of them seems to be a question of doctor's dialogue, and I think the third is a concern or a resistance to what people are defining as politically correct, liberal, social justice warrior subjects, sort of like looking at the questions of India from a minority's point of view. So, and the same with Rosa, obviously being about black history. And so I think there's three things which are mixing up and now creating this sort of, this thing about lecture sermon in this new show, which in terms of what it's actually, as you say, in story and dialogue, it's not doing.
No.
Not at all. I mean, as you were saying, I was thinking that end bit with the death of the brother. That is something that in Moffat's era, when you talk about Moffat, I was thinking, yes, the doctor or certainly the companion who's relevant would have been right involved in that. There would have been a long speech about
Clara
trying
would
to
have
stop
sent them on their way.
Oh, yes, Clara would have sent them on the way. Or if it failed, would have still had the big speech making the scene about her rather than the event.
Or one of them would have stood in between the rifle and the guy and then he used the teleport device to spirit him off somewhere else. And then they'd have told Niney, oh, yeah, he's dead. Sorry about that.
All those creatures would have been collecting souls. So even though he died, his soul would now be
uploaded
safely,
a big heavy new...
So I think you're right. I think this is a very sort of, as much as a science fiction show can go, is a very restrained sort of critical approach to looking at a part of history, which is, as we've all said, we don't probably know enough about, which we should, and done in a way which sort of tries to stay away from a lot of stereotypes. Then taking two minorities as well, sort of Indian and Pakistani, Muslim and Hindu, you know, there's a lot of things going on there, which a lot of
this is going to spark discussion. And in the same way, you know, facile creatures that we are when it comes to history, let's face it, Doctor Who fans, the only things we really know about are Marco Polo, the Aztecs, the Huguenots, you know, basically anything that was featured in Doctor Who as a historical. So our knowledge of these things is skewed accordingly. So perhaps it's a good thing. And this is an area that, we've all admitted we know absolutely bugger all about, really.
Yeah, you forgot Egyptology there as well. That's another one of those things, isn't it?
I think it's doing what Doctor Who should be doing. And that is, the character is, in theory, and obviously the character shifts whenever it suits, is about being progressive. It's about trying to represent those who aren't represented. It's about fighting a needless establishment or uncaring establishment or uncaring authority and sort of focusing on social issues where there are peaceful, good people who do feel oppressed in their time, people of colour, perhaps people of religion or sexual background, sexual identities, is things maybe the show should be sort of looking at, because that isn't that sort of emblematic of what he's meant to be about. That, you know, if you're in the majority and everything's cut hunky-dory, that's fine. He doesn't need to talk to you, unless, of course, he wants a female companion. Otherwise, you know, he's there to look after those or to represent those who don't perhaps have strong enough voice. And that's kind of what the show is doing.
Yeah. Sort of. And as a flashpoint place to go, you know, I mean, what's he going to do? He's not going to travel back in time to 20s Coventry and go to the pub, you know, and go, isn't this great? Nothing's happening. You know, it felt like a stage play, actually. That could have been a stage play very easily. We haven't talked about my favourite scene in the whole thing, which is where they split. You know, it was the night before the wedding, so they went, right, all the women are coming with me, and the doctor kind of looks, oh, yeah, okay. And the great line, oh, this is far more fun, I never did this when I was a man, and it was like, oh, doctor, you are funny. And I enjoyed that. To me, that was a subtle acknowledgement that things have changed, but it wasn't a sort of, you know, it wasn't a sort of hideous taking the doctor on a hen party to Blackpool kind of experience. Yes. It was nice.
Good Lord. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, do you feel, especially, well, both of you, since you both saw the first episode, do you feel that she's starting to find her, she seems more comfortable now? That she seems to be far more flowing to me than she did in the first episode, which is the same for any doctor. But I feel that she's starting to find a flow, although it seems to be lighting instead of flow.
I think you're probably right, but I'm not sure I'm happy with where it is in terms of the doctor. I find her. Maybe, you know, if you were going to take a band analogy, the doctor should probably be the lead singer or the lead guitarist.
Well, Hartnell wasn't, was he? I think that's where it's
Not initially, no, but later
Hartnell
on.
Hartnell was the band, that's right. Yeah.
But I'm seeing her as quirky keyboard player.
But I mean, that's what I think. I think that's where their model is, where the one feels that the model is better served, like you say, when he or she is a little more at the forefront because that's more interesting for the audience and that's what the show's about.
Yeah, I get the impression finding the right balance between getting the doctor in the right place and making it about the companions and not doing quote-unquote speeches. And we've had moments in the series so far when the doctor's attempted to do speeches and moments and they haven't come off. So either stay away from those and keep things as they are or work on those. I'd prefer it if they stay as things were in the last episode where there were no big doctor moments, because I don't think she can do them, I'm afraid.
I think I'm starting to wonder whether it's less about that and whether it's more about the incidental soundtrack. Because, I mean, when the big doctor moments were in the previous, you know, Murray Gold really amped music.
Went for it, didn't he?
Yeah, but although it helps and it informs and it gives you that shorthand, it doesn't make it work, does it? You know, like Gareth mentioned, the Capaldi one in the Zygons.
But not all of them will work. But if you take any sort of moment and you put rigorous, emotive music behind it, or if you take that out of that moment, suddenly a speech can look very bare, barren, and slightly awkward. So I don't feel the music for this season is there to support sort of what would we call it, soapboxing.
No, it's about ambience, isn't it? It's ambience and mood.
I'm just wondering, you might be right, Christian, I'm just wondering from my point of view when I see her do a couple of moments and there's not many and it feels a little odd. I'm wondering if that's to me because there is nothing there to support her doing them. She's sort of doing them fairly bare bones.
No, but
the music just sits back.
They're smaller moments. Like when she officiates the wedding, that's the closest to a little doctor speech. And that's the kind of speech people actually make at weddings. You know, so I think that was quite nice. And I think as well, Chibnall has a theatre writing background. And the one thing about theatre that I've noticed is you don't get these big, ridiculous 4-page monologues or 2-page monologues in theatre. You really don't. Because, as you say, without the music and the cuts and all the other things, it just doesn't hang together, which means they end up being quite false and eggy and difficult to pull off, you know. And I think that he's looking at it from a purposely smaller perspective, and it's better for it. But it looks gorgeous. This is one thing you guys might have picked up in the previous weeks, is that really strangely bitchy comment from Stephen Moffat that Doctor Who looks so cheap and awful, whereas I think Doctor Who hasn't looked this good.
Oh, you are way out of context, man.
Very, very, very long time.
This was in August.
Was that in August? So he had
recorded in August, and for the Sitcom Geeks podcast, and it was only available to subscribers. It was available to subscribers, and then when it became public for the general listeners of Sitcom Geeks, So for free, because it was available for Patreon subscribers, yeah. I should say. And then when it was released to the general public a few weeks ago, then The Sun picked up on it and made it sound like Stephen Moffat. Stephen Moffat, free of BBC interference, was talking about his own Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yes. Irony. So context is all. I apologise to the
Moffat. Yeah. Defending Stephen Moffat on the podcast with a K.
I did think, has he lost his marbles? Because it looks gorgeous. Mm. It looks as good as any of those prestige seasons that I watch on Netflix all the time.
He was talking about his own show, and it was something that we'd spoken about a few weeks before that, wasn't it?
His own show did look hideously cheap. Yeah. A lot of the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's fascinating. Did you read that comment a couple of weeks? It was last week, Christian, which sort of suggested that when we're reviewing these, that we now tend to be on the opposing argument side.
Yes, swap
sides from when we did Stephen Moffat's, which I kind of find quite, it's not just refreshing, but comforting, because you can sort of see, because I say, when I watched the Moffat era, for me, I think there was a lot about how he wrote, as I've said before, how he wrote companions and how he wrote women and how he wrote reactions and how they reacted that really bugged me, to the point, like I've said before, River Song would just drive me up the wall. And I kind of sort of now feel that, you'll sort of see the other side. I can now sort of see, if I didn't find that a problem, I would have probably enjoyed Stephen Moffat's era a lot more than I did. In the same way that if people watching this could be on my side and didn't find, I don't know, the preachiness a problem, if that's what they think is there, they might enjoy it like I'm quite enjoying it. I'm not massively enjoying Doctor Who, as I said last week, in the sense it still feels it needs to do something more. I mean, this episode is really, really good. I like Rosa. But I still feel like Arachnids and the one last week, it felt like it's still clinging to the 13-year-old formats that it's been doing. But having that switch around means I sort of understand other people's perspective a bit more, which is nice.
Yeah, yes, true. I mean, maybe we just all care about Doctor Who too much. We certainly overthink it. And I must admit, the very fact that I'm able to miss a couple and still feel okay, and I will catch up with them eventually. And these are all self-contained little adventures anyway, makes me feel I can watch them in any order and feel pretty good about it. So, yeah, we worry about this stuff far too much.
I think another thing, if we're just going back to audiences and ratings, one of the things which goes in its favour is, like you say, there is just so much to watch now. Yeah. If there is like a third of audiences actually, or a third, or, you know, 25% or a third of audiences tuning into Doctor Who solely on that time, that's pretty
amazing.
Good.
Because, that's amazing.
You know, even if you go back to 2012 or 2013, when you start getting Capaldi, there was just so much on. You didn't have this influx of original content, which is coming through the Amazon and Netflix and the like, which is making it harder to decide what you're going to spend the time to watch. So that could be in its favour. At the same time, I think, as well as me being positive and sort of sparring little and defending it against some of what Christian's been saying, you can't hide from the fact that there is obviously a sizable amount of people who this show isn't speaking to at the moment, who it used to. And that's interesting as well, and trying to work out why that is.
Hasn't Doctor Who always alienated part of its fan base, you know? When we all think back now, and we kind of, the haze of time makes us think Russell T. Davies' era was wonderful and we always loved it. Not the case at all.
No, you know, I wrote a book about it.
There you go.
And it starts off with generally not liking it, and then gets to the end of time, and by which point the penny's kind of dropped on what the Russell T. Davies' era of Doctor Who is.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. And you know, the Moffat era is very contentious within fandom. You have people who absolutely love it and will tell you it's the most wonderful, magical, exciting fairy tale, fairy tale that exists in television. And other people will say it's a hideous mess. And that's fine, you know, but it all goes back to, and I have to mention Horns and Nymon because it's in my contract. I love Horns and Nymon because I
do you? That.
Yes, I know. I've never mentioned it to anyone.
No, you kept that quiet. But
grew up in the Pertwee era and that Gothic Tom Baker era. And that must have been like sticking, pins in their head watching that every week for 3 years, that Williams era. Because and worse, they have nothing else to watch. If I don't enjoy the era, I don't go, oh, that's it, my life's over. And, you know, there's so much more to watch. And you just kind of accept it's not for you, but Doctor Who will be different in a year or two. Back then, if you hated Doctor Who, there was literally nothing else. Yeah. I mean, nowhere to go, nothing to watch. So, you know, however bad we think it is for certain, and so Doctor Who's always, always, always managed to alienate part of its fan base. And if it's not, I think it's impossible for it to not. Because yeah. if you want Doctor Who to be dark and grim and relenting and about death, then you're not going to enjoy season 17. If you want it to be light and crisp and witty, you know, you're not going to enjoy Eric Saward stuff.
I think you're probably right. Although I do, something that has, and is part of the reason for my low scores this series, which we'll possibly come to in a few moments to rate the latest episode. One of the things I've noticed is, there's a lack of fun about things, which I think this is partly something to do with what we've talked about with the audience being aiming, in terms of children, aiming a little older. When I've watched a couple of the early episodes with Bruce, he's watched it because it's Doctor Who, and he's liked it because it's Doctor Who. But he hasn't been gripped to it like he has been watching David Tennant or Matt Smith. And I think those, and Eccleston, I think those eras are a lot more fun than what we've got at the moment. This is more serious. And yeah. that doesn't mean that Jodie Whittaker's not quirky, because obviously she is. And that doesn't mean, you know.
It's different. I was watching season, whatever it was, the pilot, as it was called, the last Capaldi season. And there's no doubt you watch that the jokes and the quips to keep audiences entertained are fast and furious. They are constant. Click. Bam, bang, bang, yep. bang, all the way through, which isn't done anymore at all, really.
So, yeah, I think there's a difference in the fun level. Just go back to, might change, or I might be wrong. It might, you know, a few years' time, it might look a bit different. You know, like the first couple of series of, the Matt Smith era, I wasn't taken with 100% at the time. And watching it now, it seems a lot more enjoyable than I remember, so.
Going by that format, I can imagine in some ways sitting down with a 6-year-old or 7-year-old to watch Demons of the Punjab might be a challenge. But does that mean
it's not going to happen.
You know, do you then say, okay, so what we need now is, you know, Moment of Peril 8 minute in, Moment of Peril 16 minutes in, then you expand the whole Doctor Night Before the Wedding thing and underscore that with loads of Murray Gold comedy moments, and almost, you know, like that weird scene in the middle of The Unicorn and the Wasp where the Doctor's hopping around trying to get vinegar and thing. Mm-hmm. Do you have one of those great big ho 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 chuckle chuckle moments, then Moment of Peril, then Absolute Moment of Peril and Big Doctor Speech? And then next week we're off to the planet Exeter. You know, it's, I don't think that makes for a better show. I think what we have here is an attempt to go, okay,
yeah.
our audiences are holding. We're going to give the audience the benefit of the doubt and not go for the cheap formulaic stuff and see if they stick with us. And I haven't seen the audience figure, so I don't know. But I'm guessing they'll be all right, because that was, by all measures, a quality, well-made, well-thought-through piece of drama.
I mean, I'm beginning to wonder whether, because there was the big audience drop-off and it became a little more distance to maybe the kid audiences in the late Moffat ones, whether it's been a decision that this show no longer needs to be aimed at children. Maybe we need to aim at an audience which has been growing from 2012 rather than 2012.
Young adult teen.
Because it feels like young adult teen.
If the youngsters want history, they can watch Horrible Histories.
Well, maybe. Whether that's the right move for the show in the long term, I don't know. But I do feel that one of the issues here is that we've been stuck for the last 13 years in like a sort of, to quote Richard Herring, in sort of Stuart Lee, that sort of something on drugs. It feels like it's Tom Baker on acid. It's the hyperbole of the newspapers. It's that feeling that is all Doctor Who is. It's Tom Baker on hyper Tom Baker, and we've got to fire that off, and that's got to be on all cylinders through the show constantly.
Yeah, and that's Tennant onwards, isn't it?
It is.
It's certainly not Eccleston, but that is Tennant onwards every single time.
That's because that's something that Eccleston wouldn't do. But I think that's where it moved to. And even Eccleston, there were still the hints of the irrelevant eccentricities occasionally, which was... I think you're right, to be fair. I think Davis was resisting, but was still there. But what we've got now is really much a pullback to Troughton and to Hartnell, which are doctors and eras and tones in their own right, which if we sort of say it should be like this, it's sort of hyper Tom Baker, you're sort of ignoring the fact that it can be like this. Sort of hyper Tom Baker / McCoy, I suppose, maybe for the darkness.
And maybe McCoy is a good touchstone for this, actually. Yeah. Yeah, maybe McCoy. But I think it's good. I think it's genuinely good drama. And I think it's going in the right place and it's doing something a bit different. And the audience is responding.
Some are not, obviously.
But do you know, I mean, what was it? Douglas Adams always said the most you can change Doctor Who by is 15% a year. Because if you go beyond 15%, enough people notice and you have problems. And I think this is probably right at the limits of a 15%. Probably a bit more, because I think narratively and structurally and tonally, it's certainly at 15%. Then when you add a female doctor into the equation, which does change things, then you've certainly moved the dial by probably nearer 30-35% now. But the audience is with it. The audience has grown, however measure you've put on it. Because I'm sure if you've got those big overnights, and then when people start adding in all the voodoo of, you know, well, here's iPlayer, here's this, here's that, you know, it's going to be a bigger audience, the biggest audience Doctor Who's had for probably nearly 10 years. That's a success.
Yeah. Okay, so when bearing those things in mind, I did want to go back to Facebook because there's some awesome comments in there and phrases that I kind of wanted to refer to. Oh. But we were going to look at Andrew Fairbrass's comments, and he describes the aliens as the knights that say knee. Describe the episode. I love this bit. Freed from the Chibnall Quill of Doom, the writing really shone. An excellent script, a well-worn revisit of Father's Day, even if it avoided the whole Time Rupture scenario. The dialogue was poignant, real, and delivered with ease. Even the normally tortuous exposition was rolled out with aplomb. I just love the Chibnall Quill of Doom.
What is that?
I think it's a reference to some of the Chibnall episodes not firing on all cylinders. Not just in 2018. It's 2018, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I see.
That was going back to Torchwood and the Silurians and 42 and things. I don't mind 42, actually. 42.
I like
42.
I like 42.
Yeah.
Well, but I do feel, if I was Chibnall, I probably would feel a little frustrated that, you know, that he'd sort of read comments of 40-year-old Doctor Who fans like me who sort of said, right, I think you should have more companions because I'm tired of it being the single female girls. He goes, right, tick, done that. It'd be great to have an older companion in there like Wilf. Yep, tick, done that. Slow the pace down because everyone says it's too fast. Okay, we'll slow the pace down. Less sonic screwdriver. Well, we'll see if we can cut that out occasionally as well, make it a little less intrinsic, done that. A few more historicals. Yep, done that. Looks at the paper and is like, oh my God, this is so boring. It's so preachy. There's too many companions. They talk too much. They don't have enough to do. They do too much. She has little to do. She does too much. And it must be that sort of frustration for any showrunner when you just read through. And because there is always...
Don't read them, do you? You know, I mean, I'd imagine that, you know, in that list of things that Chibnall doesn't give a shit about, you know... You know, 40-year-old Doctor Who fans heading for fandom's tar pit is probably at the bottom. And that's right. That's absolutely right.
So,
we're not entitled to anything other than we pay our license and we can sit down and watch it. And if we don't want to watch it, well, there's lots of things to watch.
But the point being is, even if you try giving what people are asking for, you've still got no guarantee that they're going to respond to what you're trying to give, which is what I think he's been trying to give. He's sort of gone, well, this is like a Tom Baker show for a while. It's been funny. It's been crazy. Let's try a different tone. Let's try a different approach. And he's done that. And yeah, with those fans that have been asking for that, still don't really gel with it. Now, that could be because he's done it wrong for some people.
Well,
but
you know,
I
maybe
kind of feel that he's done the differences that are needed to try and do something different.
Maybe time has been unfair to Chris Chibnall, and maybe recorded media has been unfair to Chris Chibnall, and maybe his reputation has been unfair to him in two ways. One, he's done other shows and he's made contributions to talk to the people perhaps didn't like that much, or perhaps found very long and meandering, such as Broadchurch. And also maybe it's because of comments that he made on television 30 years ago about contemporary Doctor Who then, which can easily be transferred 30 years into the future and have quite similar meaning.
I feel so sorry for him.
Yes. Yeah.
That's like a drunken digital tattoo that he's had 30 years ago, you know, and now has to live with. It's literally, you know, like he's had too many tequilas one night and he's woken up with you know, a huge, great big facial tattoo. And oh, right, okay, I am now that bloke. to be fair, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure all the only showrunner I think who's been pretty consistent in what he thinks about the show is Russell T. Davis.
Mm.
You know, when you go back to that now almost prophetic Doctor Who magazine article where they got all those up and coming writers going to say
1999, wasn't it?
1999. He more or less did exactly what was in that article 13 years later. You know, Stephen Moffat has in past in print said some pretty hideous things about the show, which he's had to row back on quite considerably. But because it's not, you know, he's not sitting there in a flecky jacket and a piano tie in the 80s in a TV studio, then it's kind of, well, it never happened. Fake news. So I feel for him. But, you know, he's owned those comments. And let's be honest, he had a point. Doctor
Who did have a point.
Yeah. Was pretty terrible that year. It's about the worst Doctor Who I can remember ever. I think there's very little to commend that show, that whole season.
Those same comments, which for the listener who didn't see the Facebook post, it doesn't seem to have much to it. Oops. Doesn't seem to have improved since it went off the air. Could have been slightly better written, especially the last story. It was also very cliched. It was very routine, running up and down corridors and silly monsters. Could have been quite easily applied to the last episode.
Are you trying to suggest the demons of the Punjab?
No. This is referring to the last episode.
As Terror of the Vervoids.
No. The Suranga Conundrum, the episode you haven't watched.
Oh, which I haven't seen, so I can't.
Yeah, which the one that has the AI score of 79, that one.
Okay.
So, it refers to that.
Still not as bad as Sleep No More, which I don't understand why. You said that was hideous, didn't you, James? And I love that.
Yes. I didn't mind Sleep No More. I don't think it was as bad as James and Brian felt it was, but it wasn't great.
It's possibly not a Doctor Who episode. I will say that. It's probably more like an Inside
Doom.
Seeds of Doom is definitely not a Doctor Who show.
It's New Avengers, isn't it? And yet it's absolutely marvellous.
I mean, if we're going into it, the reason I didn't like it was, as I found structurally, I found it horrendously dull and by the numbers, which is probably what some people thought of last week's. So that it just sort of was running around corridors against the monsters, which didn't really do anything. They just sort of lumbered. And, you know, the big reveal at the end was an interesting reveal, but you had to go through 40 minutes of them running around corridors and hiding in rooms before using old sets we'd seen before through bad camera angles, which was a nice idea, but didn't really play to the story as much.
Mr. Sandman was quite nice.
But he didn't do anything. They didn't do anything. It's a bit like Vampires of Venice, where you have loads of very slow hissing vampires. You never do anything apart from slowly hiss at people. It's like, just not feeling the threat here.
That said, to be fair, wasn't this completely rewritten fairly late in the day? Because it was supposed to be about workers in the City of London trying to find a way not to sleep so that they would have a competitive advantage over all the other traders.
Well, that sounds more interesting.
Yeah.
But to me, that's why I didn't like Sleep No More anyway.
Okay, let's get back to Facebook briefly. Trevor Arthur, finally, really good story. Some scary aliens and the humans are the bad guys.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, Phil Vernon, enough. Four-handed leads not working. And with guest stars to boot, Jodie's Dodger is lost in the mix, like the bass guitar on And Justice for All, which is a Metallica reference.
Okay. They didn't all have something to do, that is true.
I don't hate it, but it's rather bland, continues Phil. The nearest I can liken it to is when Star Wars does stories without the Jedi. It loses some of those magical elements that make it Star Wars. Shane Rivett declares it brilliant, superb story and cast. And, yeah, I mean, there's two takes on both of these aspects, isn't there? That's got to bring us... We've got to the end of the Facebook comments, so that's got to bring us to us.
Yeah.
Rating out of 10 times. As Gareth, as you are, I guess I'm going to let you go last. James, I'm going to let you go second. Unusually, I have positive vibes about this episode of Doctor Who. And although I'm not sold on the aliens, eventual raison d'etre and the end theme tune hurt me, I'm going to give it 7.5 out of 10, which is my highest rating for this series.
Wow, Jimmy Hill likes it.
well, James.
I'm trying to decide. I really liked it. I thought for once the aliens actually kind of worked for what I think it was trying to do. I maybe thought that it was dragging a little in the last section around the marriage. I thought it was still quite beautiful, but it did feel like it was just maybe a little overlong, but I would still give it. I think, to be honest, you know, it's a bit of fun Sunday, interesting Sunday evening television. So I'm actually going to give it a 9.
Okay. It's a new type of Doctor Who. It's about emotional heart. It's peril and menace have been kind of relegated, but I'm okay with that because for once it's been done for a good reason. It's a good template. I'd like to see them have a little bit more guts next time and just go for historical. Something like the... did you ever read the terrific Matthew Jones short trip with Lady Jane Grey, the 9-Day Queen, which is fantastic. Well worth a look up if anyone can ever find Decalogue. So, yeah, ramble, great. I'll give it an 8. And I loved the final theme tune. I thought was lovely. So, yeah, 8 for me.
Excellent. Well, there you go, dear listener. I will obviously be expecting your comments on this week's podcast with a K on Facebook. And please hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review. We've had a nice new review recently, which warmed the cockles of my heart, I can tell you. I'm just going to see if I can bring it up or whether it was restricted to the US version of iTunes. Here we go. Ratings and reviews. A recent one from, actually there's been two, one's from my wife, the other one is from Tony Angelino in February, who says, I have only just discovered this podcast, surprised it doesn't have more votes, well-informed opinions on a variety of Who-related topics, an easy listen. So thank you, Tony Angelino.
The singing dustman from Only Fools and Horses.
Could quite well be. but that was the first comment we had in 3 years. So if you could leave us a comment on iTunes, that would be great. So then people can find us and also become the listener.
Quying.
So, there you go. Big thank you.
I would say I don't give a monkey's if nobody listens. I just like having a chat with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Indeed.
So if you are listening, thanks for coming. If nobody listens, we still enjoyed it.
I mean, for me, it's just like something I do now every week. It's like, I don't know. It's like eating or lavatorial duties. You know, they're just there.
You
sit somewhere in between. I don't know.
Yeah,
I think it's nice that we all enjoyed it. I think it's nice we all enjoyed it, and that's. I don't think we've had a moment where we've all really enjoyed it for a long time, and I think that's a
absolutely. I mean, in fairness, the one that I enjoyed the most before this was that penultimate one of the last season with John Sims.
Oh, that was good, the Cybermen. Yeah, yeah.
That one. The one following it was terrible, but that one was really good. And there were some nice ones last season as well, to be fair.
Yeah. That's interestingly, that got an 85 AI. which was again, the highest of that run.
It's like different tones though, and I think that's just what's interesting is a different tone. Sometimes to say it feels it's sitting a little too close to the old show. I'd like to see what you thought of Arachnids.
I tell you what, Gareth. I promise I'll watch it this week. I'm going to watch the three that I've missed on, because I watched the first 10 minutes of the second one, and then my mum's iPlayer on the little Now TV player packed up. And I thought it was okay, but I didn't get round to watching the rest of it. And I promise I'll watch the three I'm missing.
Because then you should come back, and then we'll see if that's changed your views at all, because that would be interesting.
Yeah. To see it as a whole. Yeah. Okay.
Mm. Okay.
What's next week? Are we off to the planet Google shopping or something? The planet Amazon, by the look of it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The next week's episode is called Kablam. It's set on a warehouse planet.
Good brand. It's like one of them apprentice tasks. You know, Team Kablam.
Well, Kablam to me sounds like an 8-bit video game of some sort.
Oh, you're thinking of Kaboom.
Yeah,
The Activision.
But it hits you in that way, doesn't it? Yeah.
The file share, of course, was it Kazaa or something? That was
I remember.
Kazaa, yes.
That's the bringer of great snide films.
So let's wrap this up. You know, we've been critical of Chris Chibnall throughout this series, of our listeners on Facebook have. I think it's we should probably give massive credit to Vinay Patel for creating a rather wonderful Doctor Who story in Demons of the Punjab.
Yeah.
We're going to end it there. Dear listener, we will be back next week. Leave us your thoughts on Facebook as ever. Until then, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.